Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Regular listeners to this podcast will know that we have featured several episodes on the topic of Mormonism, including interviews with economist Michael McBride on the organization of the Latter-day Saints, historian Patrick Mason on anti-Mormonism, and journalist Allison Pond talking about her experience of being an LDS missionary in Russia. Now, some of you may be wondering why such attention to a minority religion. Indeed, I've heard from a few folks wondering if I am an apologist for Mormonism. Admittedly, I am not a member of the Latter-day Saints, but I have several friends and colleagues who are. And as a social scientist, I am fascinated by this relatively modern-day religion that has witnessed phenomenal growth in the U.S. and abroad, all the while being able to secure the deep adherence of its congregants. Mormons are one of the few faith traditions that are successful in getting members to tithe close to 10% of their pre-tax income, a feat that is absolutely amazing, as any other pastor will attest to. We talked with Michael McBride about this issue, and so I urge you to go back and visit that podcast. On top of this, the selection of Mitt Romney, a devout Mormon, as the Republican Party's presidential nominee has raised interest in exploring what this religious denomination is all about. Even the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has taken advantage of this opportunity to showcase their faith with an advertising blitz on billboards showing a variety of individuals with the tagline, "I am a Mormon." This campaign, apparently, is to show us other folks that Mormons are just like the rest of us. To explore whether this is the case or not, and to find out what influence Mormons have had on American culture, I'm pleased to be joined today with Professor Lenita Neuswander, an adjunct professor of political science at the University of South Dakota, and co-author with Lee Trepanier of the book LDS in the USA, Mormonism and the Making of American Culture. And that's from Baylor University Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, as well as a wealth of other informations, including the podcast that I previously mentioned. So please drop by and check us out. And while you're there, please join our Facebook fan page to get regular updates about what we're doing on this show. We now have 267 fans, and I want to get to 300 before the school season starts here in a few weeks. Lenita, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Just a little trivia before we get started. I was doing a bit of internet research on you for our podcast, and I discovered an interesting fact. You are the only person in the United States named Lenita Neuswander. That's got to be cool or something. Did you plan it that way or something?
Yeah, well, actually, I guess that's probably how I know I was marrying the right guy, huh?
Yeah, probably. So
I didn't realize that, but now maybe I've got bragging rights to my friends or something. The only one.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I've looked up my name several times, and it turns out that there's like a Anthony Gill soccer player, and there's a radio host out in Western Massachusetts or something like that. So I thought I was pretty unique, but no.
Well,
there's...
as long as they're all upstanding people, right? I've got nobody to hide behind.
Yeah, that's it. So, yeah. Everybody's looking at you. Oh, hey, so give us a little bit of background on your new book, LDS in the USA. I noted when I read the introduction that you were the co-author on this book with Lee Trepanier, who is an associate professor of political science at Saginaw Valley State University. Now, I know Lee a little bit through his writings, and he's a Russian specialist by trade. So how did you two folks connect to write this book on Mormonism?
Sure. Well, Lee's got an interesting background, and his interest in Mormonism goes back to a time when he was teaching in Utah, in southern Utah. He was there for 4 years, and a while after that, he and I met while we were both participants at the Lehrman American Study Center at Princeton University. This was in the summer of 2009, and we were there for a couple of weeks of seminars and, you know, getting together, sharing, teaching and learning, and he had this idea that had been floating in his head since he'd lived in Utah. He'd noticed, being an astute social scientist, that things were a little bit different there. And he was kind of fascinated by Mormon culture and how it interacted with American culture writ large. So he'd seen a little bit about me. I had just completed my my dissertation. I just finished school, and my dissertation had some to do with Mormonism in the Age of Jackson. And so he approached me and said, "Hey, I've been thinking about this, tossing these ideas around. Would you be interested in doing something?" And so I said, "Sure." You know, just graduated. I was very excited to jump on board a project. And it wasn't long before he was able to find a willing publisher. He ran into Carrie Newman, who's the director of Baylor University Press, and he was instrumental in bringing this project together. So we had a few conversations by phone. It's interesting how these things work today. You know, we only met that one time at Princeton in 2009, and through the internet and telephone, we were able to get together and have this book written. So it's been a really great thing, I think.
It is a really interesting book, and it does provide a unique perspective because Lee himself is not a Mormon, but I take it that you are, correct?
Right. Yeah, that's right. And I hope that gives us a unique and balanced perspective.
How did that dynamic work? Because one could imagine that, you know, Lee is saying something about this. You say, no, that's not how it works, and back and forth, and there could be some arguments about interpretations and things like that. How did that working relationship work out for you folks?
Actually, it was really seamless between the two of us. Mm-hmm. As we outlined the book and we discussed who would write what, he really respected my certain areas that were my expertise because I had lived with these things all my life. And at other times, I understood that that I didn't possess the kind of distance and objectivity that he had.
Yeah.
And so he was able to lend a whole lot of important insight as well. Interestingly, some people have asked me, and these are Mormon friends of mine, about Baylor and how Baylor reacted.
Yeah.
Because they think, well, the Baptists are no friends of the Mormons, you know, and is Baylor going to... I'll tell you, honestly, my dad was afraid that my book was going to be anti-Mormon because of, you know, I was writing it with a non-Mormon co-author and, you know, I was publishing it with this Baptist University Press. So I think that we all happily found that everyone, of course, everyone's very professional and this is a scholarly book. It's not our opinion that we're putting out there, and we were treated very well in that respect.
I should note that our podcast is also sponsored by Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, and they don't have very much input. Actually, they don't have any input on the topics that I feature here on this show, and not even Baylor University Press. There's no quota that says you have to have so many Baylor University books or anything like that, but they completely give me a long leash here to go out and find some great topics, and this book did capture my attention. So kudos to Baylor University Press and to Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion for understanding religion in and of itself and taking a very professional attitude towards it. One of the things I noticed when I found this as a topic, I was paging through the Baylor University Press catalog and I came across your book. It was featured prominently up front, LDS in the USA. The first thing that came to my mind was that famous Bruce Springsteen song, LDS in the USA. And I even came up with some lyrics here. I got to sing them to you for a sec. The book, actually, did you have any input from Bruce Springsteen on the title?
I did not.
Okay.
No, we didn't even have to ask permission. Isn't that crazy?
No, that is crazy. How did you come up with the title LDS in the USA?
Actually, that was all Baylor.
That was Baylor. Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering if they have connections with Bruce Springsteen.
You'll have to check, huh?
Yeah, what you have to do is you get a theme song, because I got a theme song for you based on the Bruce Springsteen song. It goes like this. LDS in the USA, I was... LDS in the USA, started in Ohio and got chased away through Illinois to the Great Salt Lake. Donnie Osmond and Danny Ainge are the faith of our religious faith. We are LDS in the USA. I bet my listeners are out there clapping to that right now.
That's great. I'm dancing in my seat.
All right. Yeah, there you go. Or dancing in the dark, perhaps. There you go. Oh yeah, Bruce Springsteen. Okay, we get to put Bruce. Yep. We get to put Bruce Springsteen up as a tag on our website now, so everybody who's looking for his new album is going to end up hearing a talk.
Book. Thank you.
Yes, exactly. Very good. Very good. Okay, so let's get into the book. And you set out to explore what Mormonism has meant for American culture, is essentially to what extent it has had an impact on our national heritage. Now, you don't provide an in-depth history. A lot of other people do that, and you point to books in different directions that say, okay, if you're really interested in an in-depth history of Mormonism, look here and there. But rather, you explore a central theme, which is that the LDS religion, Mormonism, has embodied certain tensions in American culture that both reject and affirm what are considered to be core American values. And I'm quoting that, or paraphrasing a little bit from page 6 of your book. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? And first off, I want to know what you're talking about when you talk about core American values.
Yeah, that'll get somebody in trouble, right? Because everyone's ideas of what makes us American and what makes us distinct as Americans is probably a little bit different. But there are a handful of things that we pick out. We're talking about some traditional American values of home and family, especially this ideal of the Malthusian couple that you had kind of working in the first part, at least, of the 20th century. And you're right. In the book, Lee and I argue that part of the problem that Mormons have today with public perception is because of this way that Mormonism interacts with American values and culture. On the one hand, we're affirming them, and on the other hand, it seems like we're going against them, you know, going against the grain of what the mainstream is doing. So, for instance, home and family that I mentioned. And there's also the value of this hardworking American who's able to pull himself up by his bootstraps. That one in particular has garnered some interesting criticism. I just read an article recently in The New Yorker that criticized Mormonism for believing that good works bring you wealth. They were talking about Mitt Romney in particular. And really everything was kind of blown out of context. But yes and no. It's kind of part of the American dream, I think. If you live right and work hard, then you're going to be rewarded. And that isn't even a Mormon ideal. It comes from the Protestant work ethic that we've all inherited in some form or another. So you have these very American values that are reinterpreted through the lens of Mormonism, and suddenly they become strange, and the public doesn't recognize them and kind of refuses to deal with them.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that whole issue of a home and family and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps in terms of Mormon history, because this is one of these interesting tensions that you see in the historical record of Mormonism, is that they were as a religion that founded in the 1820s in Ohio, but then gets chased across the country and is part of Western migration. I mean, the right. Path that the Mormons follow are the path that, you know, you see with the Oregon Trail or with, you know, cowboys out in the West, and they really become part of that culture. In fact, one of my favorite Western movies of all time is one that most people don't think of very often, is Jubal, with Glenn Ford plays the lead role, and he's a cowboy out there who runs across a number of Mormon missionaries that are trekking across the West, and there's some tension between them and other cultures, and he, you know, learns to reaffirm U.S. tolerance and those kind of things. So give us a little historical background on how the Mormons fit into American heritage.
Sure. Well, it's a very frontier religion in its roots. Definitely, mm-hmm. That's something. You're right on that. Actually, Mormonism began in upstate New York.
I'm sorry, not Ohio. That's correct.
Yeah, and then quickly moved to Ohio.
Okay.
Pennsylvania and Ohio, and there began to be these gathering places.
I just have to break in here, is that, you know, Ohio, upstate New York, for a Westerner like me, all those states blend together, so, yeah.
Pennsylvania, it's all kind of the same.
It is, just one big blob out there, one big freeway out there on the East Coast, yeah.
Yeah, well, we are talking about small geographic distances at the beginning. But the thing is that every time that Joseph Smith gathered his people to build a Zion society, they met with persecution around them, and they made enemies around them. And so they were in some instances forced out, and in other instances just of their own free will found, you know, more promising circumstances. And so they were in Ohio and Missouri and Illinois in the early stages, in the first, within the first dozen years or so of the founding of the church, until you reach the point when Joseph Smith is martyred in Carthage, Illinois. And at that point, later, the saints kind of come together again, and they decide to move west, and they actually leave U.S. territory. They leave the United States because they're so upset with how they've been treated and how they haven't had the protections that they'd hoped they'd be able to receive from the government, that they petitioned the government for. And they leave U.S. territory only to realize that where they settled in the Salt Lake Valley was no longer Mexican territory anymore. A war had been fought and won, and it was now the U.S. again.
Mm-hmm.
But they stayed there and made a home for themselves there for a while, very separate from the rest of the United States. And that caused a lot of controversy and problems with the government, because you had Brigham Young, who was really a great, strong force. But he was revered as a prophet by the people, and he was president of the church after Joseph Smith's death, and he was also the governor of Utah Territory. So you had the same man with the political and spiritual leadership of a group of people who were really hanging on his every word. And so the government saw that as a pretty dangerous situation. So it's interesting that you mentioned that this relationship between the Mormons and the United States itself, because it's a very nuanced story.
Yeah, I want to come back, and there's some interesting issues I want to talk about a little bit later when we get to politics. But the story is a very interesting one. The history of one. It has a very Exodus quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
It has this aspect of your emigrating from the United States, but then the United States more or less catches up with you, and so you become an immigrant to the United States.
Right.
But all the while, you were still, I would guess, U.S. citizens, or if you considered yourself U.S. citizens. So you're an outsider and an insider at the same time. And this sets up, I think, this very interesting historical tension that stays with the faith for a good 200 years now.
Exactly. And, you know, the faith, a lot of people have said that Mormonism is an ethnic group, or an ethno-religious group at the very least. And I think it's interesting to think of it in that way, because we have this way of making others feel like outsiders. And it's something that, as Mormons, we're actually kind of proud of calling ourselves a peculiar people.
Mm.
It's an Old Testament term, one that Brigham Young used, and for us, being different is kind of a badge of honor. And on one hand, that's something that Mormons aren't willing to lose. As much as we'd like to fit into the mainstream, being a peculiar people is another value that we have.
Yeah, and again, that fits with this idea of these core American values of the welcoming the huddled masses. Immigrants come into our community. You're different, but we all share this similar idea of, you know, as you said before, freedom and family and hard work, and that if you're part of that, you know, come in here and welcome. And it is interesting that you mentioned that Mormons are seen as an ethno-religious group, but there is no separate ethnic Mormonism. There's many different ethnic groups have blended into Mormonism. But it does become this separate identity that becomes part of the U.S. melting pot. It's still separate, but it's part of that. So interesting tension there.
And you see Mormons, I live in South Dakota, and I lived in Utah for a few years when I went, when I was an undergraduate, I went to BYU. But other than that, I haven't lived in Utah. I just went, to visit some family near Salt Lake this summer, and it really struck me. You know, it's so different there. Being a Mormon in the minority in the Midwest and then going to Utah, where everything is the culture of Mormonism, but, you know, you're speaking of Mormons as perhaps a kind of ethnic group or a group that separates itself. Things are really different there than they are in other parts of the U.S., and it's difficult to put your finger on. But here you have a group of people, much like an ethnic group, who choose to separate themselves from the rest of society and bring themselves together. There's a lot of gathering that still goes on in Utah. When members of the church are looking to gather together, that's the place they go. And I think it's interesting that you don't, from my perspective, maybe I'm wrong, but you don't see that in a lot of other religions. You don't see Catholics moving from the Midwest saying, well, there just weren't enough Catholics here for me.
Yeah.
And you see Mormons doing that quite often. You know, we want to raise our children around strong groups of others who share the same faith as us. So there's something about our religious identity that brings us together as a people, no matter what our race or other ethnic background is. And I think the gathering, even still today, makes us unique.
Give us a little idea of how you grew up. So you mentioned you did not grow up in Utah. So you grew up in the Midwest, and you were part of essentially a minority community. Did that heighten your awareness of your religious faith, and how did that affect you personally?
Certainly. Well, I think I'm probably a Midwesterner by choice now. I grew up in Texas, in rural Texas, and you know, at times I was the only member of the church. Well, besides my brothers and sisters, the only member of church in my school or my family was, okay, one time when I was in high school, when I started high school, we moved to town. I come from a large family of 18 children.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so it's difficult in small town Texas for us to kind of blend in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came into town, I'm starting high school, ready to just kind of, you know, sneak under the radar and, you know, be a normal person like everybody else. And in the newspaper, the week before school started, there was this front page article about my family, you know, with a little paragraph about, you know, all of us. Juanita plays a clarinet or something like that, you know, and, oh, it was just the most mortifying thing. There was no hiding under a rock there.
Yeah.
Because Mormonism was something that, in the eyes of my peers, made me completely different. You know, no matter what else they knew about me, everybody was friendly, but they regarded my Mormonism very suspiciously, I think.
Yeah, that can only have, you know, an effect on a teenager, is that, you know, you're trying to fit in with everybody, and all of a sudden you're front page news, and you're like, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Easier, those 18 kids.
Yeah.
But then the good news is, you know, people like us come from all over the country, and then we go to BYU, where we are part of the majority, and it's such a relief to many of us to finally be a part of something and be around people who are, you know, oddly familiar to us, even though they're strangers. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's another interesting part of the gathering experience. It's almost like a coming of age thing, you know, for Mormon youth to gather together, and then you get married, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and then go off to your own corner of wherever. And yeah.
Which is now South Dakota.
Which is now South Dakota for us. Who'd have thought? Yes.
Okay. Interesting. I actually have a historical link to South Dakota, too. My ancestors were pioneers or homesteaders out there. So it's kind of interesting. Just recently found that out. So that must be rather interesting. Did you ever do a Mormon missionary?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't. My husband did.
Okay. And so that, I guess that's part of the two, you know, binding people together. You end up, you're paired with somebody, and you're in groups of people in,
sure,
you know, different corners of the world, and you get that sense of solidarity. I think that comes through that.
Right, and you're really separated from the world. Of course, you did an interview not long ago with a woman sharing her mission experience, but you're really cut off. You're not watching TV. You're not watching movies. You only talk to your parents on the phone at certain prescripted times, you know, Mother's Day and Christmas, I think,
mm-hmm.
a couple of times a year. You're encouraged to email and write letters and all that sort of thing frequently. But really, your mind is just on the work that you're doing and the people who you're living with.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other core American values that you mention in your book is this issue of religious tolerance. Again, we are a society that prides itself as a melting pot. We welcome people from all over the world with different ethnic heritages and different religious traditions. To what extent has Mormon history represented this whole issue of religious toleration?
That's a great question. There are a lot of debates or a lot of issues raised by the Mormon Church that I think kind of define religious tolerance and how the U.S. government handles the separation of church and state. For example, the obvious thing that comes to mind is polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of the early LDS faith. It was something that was practiced by a few members, not all members of the church. And it's part of the reason that they were heavily persecuted at the beginning and why they moved west to what became Utah Territory. And they weren't left alone to practice their faith there. They were pursued by the government. the Republican Party actually made it one of its first political platforms was to eradicate polygamy, which they said was a barbaric act. And so it's interesting to look at the court cases and documents surrounding the legislation against, there's the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, and then going all the way to the Edmonds-Tucker Act in 1887 or something like that. So you have a couple of decades of legislation happening, and Supreme Court cases in the interim, a lot of persecution of people. And the Supreme Court upheld that religious belief could not be justification for breaking the law, which on face value, a lot of us can deal with, right? I mean, it sounds good. We're not going to let people murder others because they say that that's what their faith is, etc. But in this case, the law wasn't created until after, it was created in reaction to what the LDS Church was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a special circumstance there. Interestingly enough, the situation was that the church itself was actually disincorporated, and all of its funds, about $50,000, were seized as property of the U.S. government, and its leaders had to go into hiding, etc., until in 1890, when they renounced the practice of polygamy. And even then, it was a slow and long road to full incorporation, to statehood, and then eventually having people seated in the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives without federal intervention. Because for a time, you had the federal government appointing leaders in Utah Territory because they just didn't have trust of the Mormons. So even though a lot of what our country means to us is based on religious tolerance, I mean, in elementary school, we all learn about the pilgrims, right?
Mm-hmm.
Come to America because they're seeking religious freedom, and this is the city on a hill that they create, and it's, you know, a wonderful place where they can do their own thing. Joseph Smith was able to found this religion because of those values. There are not many other places where that kind of tolerance would have existed. He probably would have been stopped before he got very far. So those are values that we all hold dear to us as Americans, and yet still there are some pretty stringent limits to what American society will stand for as far as religious pluralism goes.
And that's a constant theme that we have here on our podcast series, because I happen to be very interested in the topic of religious liberty, having written on it myself. And you mentioned the pilgrims, too, is that we get this image that pilgrims came over for religious tolerance. But you have that ideal that is set up, and then Roger Williams as well, breaking away from the Congregationalists to found Rhode Island or Providence. And so you get this ideal set up. But throughout American history, we fall short of that ideal quite frequently. In fact, the Puritans, the Congregationalists, became very much engaged in persecution of other religions, such as the Quakers. And even though you had the ideal of religious pluralism, Catholics weren't treated very well in the colonial days. And so, yes, there's this opening. We have this ideal that says religious toleration, religious pluralism within limits. And I think your point that religious liberty has some limits is very well taken. You can't just have a murdering cult or anything like that, as we talked with on a previous podcast with Jonathan Fox. But you know, certainly a very broad range for what you can do with your faith here in the United States. But yet, we're human beings, and we fall short.
Right.
But nonetheless, having that goal there and having that reminder that we have to tolerate one another, I think is very important. And for me, when I read Mormon history, that really comes to the fore for me. And it, you know, bringing it up to contemporary times, a lot of evangelicals within my circles have been very critical of Mitt Romney because of his Mormonism. And they say, well, this is horrible. I said, but you know what? This really tests our own tolerance here. And, you know, we're not electing a religious leader in chief. We have the separation of church and state. So if he's Mormon, you know, what does that really matter to us? Is our faith so weak that we would become the faith of whoever happens to be president at the time? That's not what it's about. It's that we allow different religions to flourish here in the United States. And I think that really is the story of Mormonism and really what a lot of us can learn, us non-Mormons can learn from that experience.
Right. And poor Mitt Romney, he didn't ask to be a poster child for Mormonism.
Yeah.
You know, and have that be the watchword of his campaign. And the poor guy is one of, I mean, people say he's one of the most boring politicians we've seen on the national stage in a long time. You know, I don't understand what's threatening about him other than he's not wearing his faith on his sleeve. He's no Rick Santorum,
right.
Mike Huckabee, who's really rallying the conservative troops like that.
Or even a Jimmy Carter. I mean, yeah. Jimmy Carter based his campaign around, hey, I'm a born-again Christian, and you can't trust the Nixon and Ford and Republicans, so, you know, turn to me now. It's kind of interesting. Let's talk about Mitt Romney a little bit later, because he's right now the prominent faith of Mormonism. Let's talk about some of the other folks who have been associated with Mormonism and how that has affected the culture over the past 30 years or so. One of the first chapters of your book does this really well. And for me, it's very surprising because, again, you think, well, it's a minority religion. They're all just out there in Utah, so they really don't have any impact. Occasionally, they have some Olympics out there and there's some skiing, and that's all good. I was quite surprised to find out how much Mormons have had an impact on the culture. So tell us a little bit about these folks and how that has affected our view in contemporary times about what Mormons are. And I guess I want to just start off with probably the most famous Mormons of the 1970s that I remember very well watching on television, and that's Donnie and Marie Osmond.
Right. Yeah, that's where we start out with. Donnie and Marie, everybody sees them, and they've got this squeaky clean image, which Donnie later said was there was some pressure for him to uphold. But those are the kind of Mormon values. And you know what? That was kind of a period of time, I think, where Mormon values were running close to American values, American mainstream values. Even if America wasn't practicing them so much, we had this ideal of the squeaky clean teenager, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we wanted to see, and that's what we put in front of us. It's kind of a far cry from what we see on reality shows today.
Yeah, I have to make mention of the Donnie Marie Osmond show, because I did watch it in the 1970s, and I think the Osmonds too were on a number of variety shows throughout the time. And I'd always go over to my grandpa's house, and they had a television, they had the three channels, and they only kept it on, I think it was NBC, if Donnie and Marie were on that, because they never would turn to ABC or CBS. It's one of the odd things is that I had a family that was brand loyal to a network, no matter what they put on. And so I would have to sit through Donnie and Marie, and you know, I kind of watched, they had songs, they had little funny skits, the typical 70s sitcom variety show kind of thing. And, you know, I didn't, as a kid back then, I didn't, you know, think about what's their religious face or something. I just said, you know, they're, you know, singers that are very clean cut, and okay, they look pretty non-threatening. So, you know, what's the big deal with Mormonism? They're, you know, they sing songs and, you know, make jokes.
Right, that's what we do.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's very cool. Now, recently, and as you mentioned with the different reality shows here, we've kind of, the pendulum has swung from the clean-cut, squeaky, clean image of Donnie and Marie to now HBO has some series called Big Love, and there's a Broadway play, I think, based upon the Book of Mormon. And what's that about? I've never seen any of those shows or seen that Broadway play.
Yeah, Big Love, there was a lot of controversy there. The show just recently ended in the last year or so, but it went on for a long time, and it had some critical appeal, but it was about a group of offshoot Mormons who practiced polygamy. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea of Big Love, right? And now you have the reality show Sister Wives. Have you heard of that one?
I have not.
Oh, it's on TLC. You should check it out.
Okay, I only watch football and psych, so.
Yeah, so this is another story of a real person who's got a man who's got a number of wives and is raising his family. And actually, after he started airing his show, there was some fear of him being pursued by the state authorities in Utah. And so he moved his family to Las Vegas, where he felt like people would be more tolerant.
Anything goes in Las Vegas.
That was kind of the idea.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, there was an episode showing them, okay, I don't really sit and watch all of these, but I did see this one. They moved to Vegas, and they're meeting the neighbors. Everybody's having a block party, and people find out about them, and it's so funny to hear people's reactions, because maybe they have this ideal of tolerance, anything goes, you know. Man can dress like a woman at night if that's what makes him happy, you know, but if he's got three or four wives, that's something we're not always so willing to stand for. I have to make clear, though, you know, we talk about Big Love and Sister Wives and their relationship to the kind of this broader idea of Mormon culture, but they are not associated with the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is the mainstream, which is the main branch of Mormonism. The LDS Church did practice polygamy for a time. It was renounced in 1890, and since then it has not been practiced. If any member of the LDS Church is practicing polygamy, they're excommunicated from the church.
Yeah. And it wasn't even a widespread practice back in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's true.
It was a rather small number of people that did practice it. And you make a very important point here, especially for us non-Mormons. And I want to reemphasize this point, too, because, you know, we see Big Love, we see Sister Wives, and we hear the, you know, different stories in the news about, you know, this guy's on the run and he's a polygamist and stuff. And we tend to associate with the LDS Church, which we think is just one big monolith, right? It represents everything. But there are, just like any other Protestant denomination or religious denomination, there's all these different schismatic offshoots that are not associated with the church. And so, to some extent, the media is not doing a favor to Mormonism in general by portraying this minor sect or schismatic movement as being the main church.
Right. And it is a lot of bad press. A few years ago, the first time Mitt Romney was running for president, there were some polls. People were asked, what's the first word that comes to mind when you hear Mormon? And most frequently, they said polygamy.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, interesting, and the church took a lot of steps to kind of change that perception. But you're right. That's something that has to do with the LDS Church historically. And, you know, there are great conversations to be had on that if one is interested. But now they're practiced only by these minority offshoot groups who have no affiliation with the mainstream LDS Church.
Now, if I had been called for that survey and asked what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear Mormonism, it actually would have been Jell-O. Because I know that in Utah, Utah has the highest per capita consumption of Jell-O in the United States. So what's this relationship between Jell-O and Mormonism? This must be cleared up now.
Sure. Okay. I'm actually ready for this because my husband and I were sitting around on the couch the other night, you know, flipping around on the iPad. And it's funny, all the stories on Mormonism that are popping up now, and suddenly everything is newsworthy. And there was a story about what is the deal with Mormons and Jell-O?
Mm-hmm.
And we're Mormons, right? We kind of ask ourselves the same thing. So we just kind of looked at it and got a laugh. But apparently, I don't mean to prove you wrong here, but Utah isn't even the highest per capita Jell-O consumption anymore. They lost it to Iowa.
Okay.
And then there was this big pull to get it back. And I think that's when things kind of happened.
Eat that Jell-O.
Yeah, that's when they decided to call it, it's the official state food or something like that. State snack, I think, is Jell-O. And so they did this big push and campaign because, I think it was just, a public relations kind of thing. You know, make the state of Utah stand out, make it look a little bit friendly and people want to come visit. And so that's something they kind of hitched their nail on. They may have gotten the Jell-O title back from time to time. I don't know. I think it shifts back and forth, but, yeah, it's in Utah, you go to a potluck, and Jell-O is part of the salad course. It's not dessert. It's a salad.
Yeah, and I have to admit that for me it's kind of fascinating, and I can understand why Utah would be a big Jell-O consumer, because in growing up, I came from an Irish Catholic family, and there was a lot of big families. We also had a lot of Polish folks in our family too. So, whenever there was a picnic with, you know, family get together, you know, my aunts always made some Jell-O salad. It was always somebody's aunt who made that. And so, you know, given the emphasis that Mormons place upon family and family gatherings, one could only expect that there's going to be some Jell-O with miniature marshmallows and carrot shavings in it.
Yes, and they get very elaborate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure there are Jell-O contests and carving, sculpture carving contests with Jell-O and stuff. So, yeah, very cool. So Mitt Romney, we're talking about Mitt Romney, and I want to get to him in just a second. We'll kind of finish off our podcast with him because he's the big news of the day. But reading your book, I was also amazed to find out how many other folks are how many other Mormons, I should say, have been involved in shaping U.S. culture. And some of the names are quite astounding. If you could just kind of review some of them for us, that would be fantastic.
Sure. Well, a big one that we talk about who's been in the spotlight a lot lately is Stephanie Meyer, the author of the Twilight series of books. Interestingly, there's a quote in the book, somebody refers to her. People talk about how she makes her character sexy without sex, and they call it the erotics of abstinence.
Yeah.
And you're probably a big fan of books. I'm sure you've read them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because they take place out here in Forks, Washington.
Oh, right.
And I have to admit, this was a stunner when I read the book because, my wife was into reading these books for a while, and we got a lot of teenage girls in the neighborhood who, when the movies come out, they're all excited and giddy, and they got to get out there. I don't know anything about the series. There's vampires, there's werewolves. This looks like your typical teenage trashy novel kind of thing. And so I was absolutely stunned to find that Stephanie Meyer was a Mormon. And
yeah. Well, come on. They saved themselves for marriage. That's a...
Yeah, I didn't know that. I just knew vampires and werewolves.
That's the kind of thing you want your daughter reading, right?
Yeah. I'm more of a zombie guy, so that's probably why I never connected.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of popularity there, a lot of influence for sure on the culture, whether people realize it or not. And Stephanie Meyer is one, as a lot of LDS authors and other public figures admit, when your religion is such a big part of your life, you can't fully separate it from what inspires you.
Mm-hmm.
So even if she's not set out to create the big Mormon novel, the Mormon American novel, what she believes and what she understands is true is reflected in the things that she writes. And she's not going to go against that.
Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting point because you make this, you have this discussion in your book, which I found interesting, is that there are a lot of people writing about their Mormonism, but it tends to be a rather narrow group of literature. It's published by, I think, Deseret Publishers. And, it's Mormons writing for Mormons.
Right.
But all of a sudden here you get this breakout, Stephanie Myers, that she says, no, I want a big audience. I want to sell lots of books because that's kind of neat. So yeah,
Deseret Book won't even cover her book.
Wow.
But, yeah. And then you have this, another self-selective group. It's been dubbed lovingly Mollywood.
Yes, Mollywood. Tell us about Mollywood.
Okay. So Mollywood, it's Mormon Hollywood, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who are really goody-goody Mormons are sometimes known as Molly Mormons. That's some insider lingo for you. So Mollywood is this squeaky clean, very values-heavy side of movie production. So these are movies that are created by Mormons and for Mormons. And mostly they're in limited release. When I was up in Utah, I saw, billboards for Charlie, which was this great novel that I think this was the 10th anniversary of the first time the movie came out or something. It was a novel written several years ago. But, that had a great Mormon following and probably wouldn't have done so well anywhere else. A lot of times these are lower budget films, but they're beloved by the people anyway. They have some kind of insider humor, that others wouldn't appreciate. And it's a fun way that that artists are able to practice what they believe, and people are able to kind of get together and coalesce about the thing around the things that we have in common.
Yeah, you had a quasi breakout movie recently that I had a chance to glimpse at was called Church Ball, and it had a pretty interesting cast. It was kind of a lot of Hollywood has-beens had been in this film, and it's about a church basketball league and all the conflicts that does. And even though it's Mormon based, it really resonated with me. Church softball league, everybody's always arguing about stuff, and even though you're supposed to be very Christian about everything, but it starred I forgot the guy who played Willis on that show. He died recently, the short guy. I can't remember who he is.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the movie. I didn't know he was in it.
Yeah, no. So this is kind of funny. So who are some of these other folks that I should mention this. Again, reading through your book, one of the big surprises for me was Gladys Knight, who is one of my all-time favorite Motown singers with Midnight Train to Georgia and Someday We'll Be Together, two of my all-time favorite songs. And I was Gladys Knight's a Mormon? Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, actually, it's interesting how she came around to Mormonism. She was a convert to the church in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're a fan of hers, you probably know that she had some struggles earlier on in her personal life, and her son and daughter had joined the Mormon Church in the late 80s, I think, several years before she did, and they're the ones who introduced her to the faith eventually, and once she grabbed hold, she was really kind of firmly embedded, and that's something that she's really been proud of and held on to ever since.
Yeah, it's interesting that she's a later convert, too, because, again, when the other thing that a lot of people think about when somebody says Mormons to them is usually the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I mean, you're great singers, and I have some friends who are Mormons who are just astounding voices. And, you know, Gladys Knight, I would say, yeah, of course, she comes from church choirs. But, you know, now, you know, that she's a later convert, you adding her to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and, you know, maybe a little Motown-y blues kind of stuff going on there.
Yeah, there you go. You should write that into Salt Lake.
Yeah, yeah, I should do that. That'd be kind of fun. So, and then one other big guy who is, you know, hit the scene like an atomic bomb a few years ago is Glenn Beck. And how has
bomb that's yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's an interesting character. He's also a Washingtonian, by the way. Then we talked about Forks, Washington as being the setting for the Twilight series. But also, I think Glenn Beck is from the Mount Vernon area out here or somewhere nearby. How has Glenn Beck affected the country's view of Mormons?
Wow. You know, just this morning I was getting up, looking at a couple of things, getting ready for this interview, and I saw an article where a woman was really despondent that her her niece had gone to this LDS, kind of like a youth rally sort of thing, and Glenn Beck was the speaker. She was just so offended that they would have a political person up there kind of preaching to the kids. And of course, but he's such a great figure to rally around. You know, he's really good at getting people excited. I think mostly within the LDS Church, we're happy to have him as one of us, you know, with all of his quirks and, you know, whether you agree with his politics or not, he's a fascinating guy and he's never shy to share his, the story of his conversion and the story of his faith. And he is one who certainly owes a lot of who he is as a public persona to his faith. He was a convert later in life. He did have a radio career for a long time before he joined the LDS Church, but people who are big followers of his can trace a real shift in his ideology and in his personality from the time that he joined the LDS Church, and he freed himself from some of the addictions that that had been bothering him for so long. He, for example, has a real, you know, we talk about Mormons having kind of a reverence for the United States and the Constitution and this religious fervor to their patriotism. And Glenn Beck completely embodies those feelings.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. And I'm going to come back to that in a second, but just a few thoughts to finish up with Glenn Beck is he is such a quirky character. I mean, he's brash, he's outspoken, he does goofy things sometimes, and then he also cries on television. And, you know, it's one of those things, and this goes along with the LDS campaign, you know, with all the billboards that say, "I am a Mormon," that says, you know, we're just like everybody else. I mean, there is the Donny Osmond.
Cry on TV, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we all cry on TV. Well, we struggle with addictions and, you know, we're just like everybody else kind of thing. Because again, us non-Mormons don't think of that. We think of Donny Osmond or, you know, one of those people from Big Love or Sister Wives as the persona. But I mean, you're Mormons are throughout the culture. In fact, I, you know, share my own experience when I was flying out to Salt Lake City one time. I sat next to Danny Ainge, who was a former Boston Celtic, and I think he played for BYU or somewhere. You know, so that was pretty cool. But also the other guy on the other side, who I found even more fascinating than a professional basketball player, was this short guy who was a cage fighter. He was a mixed martial artist. And, you know, when he told me that, I said, "You're a Mormon?" He says, "Yeah." And I'm like, I didn't think Mormons would cage fight, but I, you know, they do everything just like everybody else, and they eat Jell-O and they cry on television. So, and your book highlights that very well. Is that, you know, Mormons are part of the American experience. They're not; they're a little bit separate, but also they're part of it. And
right, and you know, sometimes I think Mormons are kind of getting to that point where we're mentioned more in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, of course, now with a lot of scrutiny on Mitt Romney, that's the case. But in recent years, it's been building up. You know, there are Mormon characters on on TV shows or sitcoms, and they're kind of normal people. They're not the big love polygamous characters. You know, they're not stereotyped as Donnie and Marie. They're just everyday people. Interestingly, on The Bachelorette, this most recent season, you're probably a big fan of Bachelorette.
Oh, absolutely.
I think so.
Yeah, I've missed every episode that they've had on, but it's definitely on my list of the next 5,000 shows I want to see. Yeah.
Well, so the winner this year, so this woman, Emily, chose her new fiancé was Jeff Holm, who is a member of the LDS Church.
Oh.
And he made a deal saying, you know, at the beginning saying, like, this is part of who I am, but I'm not practicing, or he's, you know, he's Mormon, but he's not Mormon, something like that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that his religion didn't play a part, a large part in the show. It was hardly mentioned. In fact, there's a time at the end when the Bachelorette gets to go and meet the families of her prospective choices, you know. And Jeff's parents are in South Carolina, I think, serving an LDS mission. They're mission presidents for the church, so they're overseeing all of these young men, you know, who are out being missionaries. And so they're gone, and he wasn't able to spend the time with them or, you know, do the usual thing that people who are fans of the show are used to seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just a line of explanation given on the show. And interestingly, I didn't see it, but I read that when he said his parents were on a mission, it was voiced over, and you can see his lips saying mission, but it says service. Like, his voice said service.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of an effort, I think, to cover up what it was that his parents were doing and what exactly, how involved he was in the LDS church.
Yeah.
To play that down, and maybe it was because producers thought that it was a polarizing thing.
Huh.
But in any case, we do have more members of the church being accepted into, you know, being portrayed in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that the media chooses to reflect their values, or, you know, give them the chance to shine or share their Mormonism or not, is still at issue, I think.
So a reality show producer worried about something that's polarizing. Now, that's a rarity. I thought they would just, you know, wallow in that. And it is interesting, you know this in the book as well, is that a lot of these reality TV shows, from MTV's The Real Life to Survivor, there's a lot of Mormons represented, I think higher than their proportion in the population. So Mormons are good reality show candidates, I guess.
Yeah, I guess we are. We're cutthroat.
Yeah.
Yeah, we kind of make the point that Mormons, you know, we encourage a lot of, you know, our children to build talents and to perform them in, you know, in front of others. We have talent shows and road shows and those kind of fun things. And I guess that just allows children to grow up and show them off on TV like that.
I guess it must be the case. I want to finish up here in the last 10 minutes or so with talking a little bit about politics. And there's been an interesting question that I have always had, and I pose this, I think, to Patrick Mason and a few others, not on this podcast, but I have a lot of Mormon students out here at the University of Washington, and through political science, we usually get a lot of people who want to go into law school. Actually, a lot of the folks who are Mormons, I'm always writing recommendation letters, are going into the U.S. State Department. And it's fascinating to talk with these students and with my other Mormon friends, is that the reverence that they show for this country, the level of patriotism, is remarkably high. And for me, it sets up this interesting paradox, is that, you know, Mormons have been chased away from this country. They were pushed out to be emigrants into the country, and there was tension, and then bringing them back in. And as you mentioned, the Republican Party first platform was, you know, geared at ending polygamy and targeting Mormons. And yet, Mormons remain the most patriotic members of our society by any given poll, and mass, they tend to vote Republican, and, you know, very, very patriotically so. And, you know, Utah is a safe state for Republicans in any given election. I don't think either of the candidates will be making any stops there this year, because it's a given to go to the, you know, the red tally in terms of elections. So what explains the fact that you have this persecuted minority religion yet embraces the nation that persecuted them?
Yeah, well, we've talked a little bit already about the historical ties of the religion to to its American place. I mean, obviously, it was born in the USA, right? But that doesn't set it apart, because there are lots of religions that were started in the U.S. But what's interesting is that LDS theology has a lot in it, specifically about the United States. For instance, Mormons today honor and revere the Founding Fathers as inspired leaders, and we believe that the Constitution is a divinely inspired document. This is something actually that's spoken of in modern revealed scripture. And so these are things that are dear to us. So the Book of Mormon itself talks about North America as a land of liberty. It's a story of the children of the House of Israel who migrated to the Americas, and they founded great societies here. And they had prophets and direct revelation from God. They were even visited by Jesus Christ himself after his resurrection. So if you read the Book of Mormon, you see the key role that the land itself plays in all of this. Additionally, according to more modern revelation, we believe that North America was the site of the Garden of Eden, that things started here. This is where Adam and Eve were, and this is where Adam walked with God and talked with God. We also believe that Christ visited here since his mortal ministry in Jerusalem, and that when the end of time comes, and there's the end of the world and the millennium, Christ will reign personally over the earth from his seat of government in the New Jerusalem, which will be located not in any vague place, but specifically in Jackson County, Missouri. It's interesting kind of too that there's a geography to all of this, to all of these key points of our religion, and that geography is largely situated here. We believe that that God is a God for all people, and that he spoke to his people in the old world and in the new, and that the United States and the land that it sits on has a big part to play in all of that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, it sets up, as you mentioned, geography, but also the Constitution and the ideals of liberty and such, is that, it sets up the ideals. Even though the people inhabiting the land, the people who are, part of representing the U.S. Constitution or implementing it are imperfect. They're sinners, essentially, and that it kind of makes for a rather interesting tension that can come about there. So that's a good explanation. So let's finish off by talking about Mitt Romney here. And I mean, this is the big issue now for the next couple months before the election's coming up. He doesn't make a big deal about his religion, but everybody else is helping to make it a big deal for him. And early in the primary season, about a year ago, there were a number of evangelicals that were very outspoken against Mitt Romney and considered Mormonism not to be a Christian religion. And over the past year or so, that really has seemed to temper itself. And so give us some of your reflections on what Mitt Romney means for Mormonism and Mormon representation here in society, and also in relations between, my community, evangelicals, and the Mormon community writ large.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned that there was a lot of skepticism over his religion during the primaries, when Republicans had the opportunity to choose between evangelical leaders or more secular leaders versus this Mormon potential candidate. But now that he's the presumptive nominee, things have quieted down a little bit, I think, at least from the Republican side of the story. And the stories about Mormonism are still rampant in the media, but they're about things like Jell-O. Mm-hmm. They're not really as hard-hitting as they had been in the past. Not to say that won't change as the election season heats up. But Romney's religion, of course, has been part of his story for as long as he's been in politics. When he ran for, when he was a presidential hopeful in 2008, well, in late 2007, he delivered this Faith in America speech. Maybe you remember.
Yes, actually, I'll try to find that link to it, because it was a remarkable speech. It was actually, as somebody who cherishes religious liberty, for me, I thought that was a very defining speech of his 2008 campaign.
Well, did you find that it didn't get a whole lot of press?
None at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And some have said that maybe it was too little too late. People had been clamoring for Mitt to talk about his religion, to say something about it because people were so suspicious, you know, of his Mormonism, or they didn't have any idea really at that time what values to associate with it. But he was mum until very late in the game, and I think it was December 2007, he gives this Faith in America speech that, as you're right, I think it was really great. But people today say he hasn't really shown any personality, and that if we could have a glimpse at his face, maybe that would humanize him, you know, because he wouldn't be a robot and we'd see this softer, more caring side of him. I don't know what reasoning he uses to justify his silence on religion, but that's his right, unquestionably.
Yeah.
He's silent about it if he chooses.
Yeah, and I guess in part that, you know, you don't want to make, I mean, he's running for, you know, president. He's not running for pope, or, you know, the equivalent of whatever religious head for any denomination would be. And so that is interesting. I have to admit, though, when you mentioned that, you know, people think of Romney as boring, I'm wondering to what extent that Donnie and Marie Osmond aura is rubbing off on him, because when I've watched him speak, he's actually a very engaging speaker. I find his, you know, the way he presents his ideas to be, you know, very engaging. And I never really understood he's a boring guy
on late night talk shows, you know?
Yeah.
Singing the blues, or, he doesn't have anything quite like that.
Yeah.
Or any, fault him for it.
Or any major foible, right? Everybody's always looking for the major foible.
Well, you know, there was the dog thing.
There was the dog thing. But, you know, I have to admit, you know, we got a golden retriever, and I think my golden retriever would love to ride on the top of my truck, because he loves sticking his head out of the window, and I think he's like, oh, put me on the top of that car. Yeah, so... Yep. so what do you think the effect, you know, is recording this in late August, so August 22nd here, and the Republican convention is just starting up here in Tampa, and we're after Labor Day, we're going to be heading full force into the presidential campaign. What effect do you think Mitt's Mormonism is going to play in the campaign? And then in the second part of this question is, to what extent will the focus on Mormonism in his campaign have an effect on the general perception of Americans, which they have toward Mormons?
Sure. Yeah, those are great questions. You know, even though Mitt Romney has been pretty silent about his religion, it doesn't keep the media from wondering. And I heard you mention on an earlier podcast that people are getting tired of hearing the phrase the Mormon moment.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I think that a lot of people feel that way. But much of the public curiosity surrounding his religion has quieted down, and focus, I think, has begun to shift to issues and other matters like his taxes or his dog on top of the roof of his car, as things kind of get down to the nitty-gritty. But if you look at polls, political polls, Pew Forum or ABC polls, they've showed a trend. For example, in late 2011, when people were asked to associate a word with Mitt Romney, Mormon was the predominant response. But by March of 2012, the leading responses were no, no way, and rich.
Mm.
Now, that probably doesn't bode very well for the Romney camp, but I think it really demonstrates a public move toward issues other than faith.
Mm-hmm.
His Mormonism is there, but people are more adamant about the rich and no way part than mm-hmm. they are about the Mormon part. In the past, for example, when Romney was feeling around for the 2008 election, a large chunk of the population was unwilling to vote for a Mormon president. In fact, there was one poll that came out and said 48% of Americans would have a hard time voting for a Mormon. That's in stark contrast to an ABC poll from earlier this summer that showed that only 18% of Americans would not vote for a Mormon president. So I think even though in the media you still see a lot of questioning, a lot of perhaps suspicion around Romney's Mormonism, among the general public, you see that people are a little bit more relaxed and a little bit more willing to give him a chance. It's only atheists and Muslims and gays that people would rather vote for less often than a Mormon.
Mm.
And that's kind of a step up from them. I mean, that's a drop of 20 to 30% in just a few short years.
And I guess I wonder, and just to conclude our podcast here, as we're running a little bit late, but the it's an interesting perspective or interesting take on how things are in relation to your book, LDS in the USA, is that you see this movement away from, no, I would never vote to a Mormon, to, well, yeah, he's a Mormon, whatever. I mean, it kind of reflects part of American culture. We do have high standards and certain virtues that we always try to live up to. We fall short of them quite often. But, you know, when push comes to shove, when we have to make a check on a ballot, or when we have to interact with our neighbors, you know what? Those issues of religious tolerance really do help shape who we are here in this country.
Amen.
Well, Lenita, it's great talking with you, and we'll keep up to date and see how things progress in the election, and maybe have you back on again on the show. So I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Awesome. Thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.